together, all those limitations. I was just informed when I came through that door. But we must eat, and we will do so. There's still a program meeting running in the NCP, so two of our NCP members are still engaged there in the program meeting regarding October, November's parliamentary program. So they will then join. That's from the NCP side. I don't know if there's any apologies from the standing comment and appropriations.
Thank you.
Apologies.
Thank you, sir. If I may start, President, we have four apologies from the third committee and appropriations. The pending apology of time is only apology for Ms. Matara, apology for the secretary, Mr. Monari, and apology for Ms. Matara. And then we'll have some apologies from Ms. Matara.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members and officials. I have the two apologies on the same concern appropriations. That is the chairperson of the committee, Mr. Paul Masakura, and Mr. Kobaza from the agency.
Honorable members, do we accept the apologies? Proposal for acceptance? Seconded? Thank you. Agreed. I recognize the member.
I would like to leave a self-concern for you. I'm passing in the respect. Thank you, sir.
Our guys, like myself, coming from the Northern Cape, must wait until that 10 to 5. There's no other choice. You must take the train or the bus. But all right. The FSC has the time constraints here for members, so let's do and deal with the work in business fashion. Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you. I would also like to visit the job setting. I am leaving at 12:30.
Thank you. Fine. The presentation of the FSC today is very important because it is linked to the NEPDF that will be presented and tabled on the 21st of October, setting the tone for the national budget. So what is presented today must be seen and read in that context. And it's very important that what we receive today we take back to our provinces where we come from and our constituencies to go and explain to our people. First, where does the money come from? And how is the money divided? What are the priorities? And secondly, the economic environment that we are operating in, experiencing sluggish growth, to which we have to adapt. That is the picture. So with that short background, I'm handing over to the leadership of the FSC to take us through the presentation, bearing in mind what you just heard and members
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me also start with an apology of the acting chairperson of the FSE, Bogani Mamalo, who is unfortunately out of the country today, and asked me to be in his place. We've got a team of our experts here. Next to me is Dr. Thomas Mabuhu, the research director, and now the acting CEO. Then, as we go down the chairperson is the acting CEO, then how do you 29th of May, and we then was determined to be invited, and the invitation came. That one here. We have done 8 of the 9 provinces in terms of the constitution. The recommendations are submitted to the provincial legislatures plus to the national legislature. We've got presentations of 8 of the 9, and the only one outstanding is the proposal, which will be done on the 6th of October.
Excuse me, do you engage executives in your engagement with legislators?
No, it would be obviously within the leadership would be in those committees, but it is in terms of the constitution to the legislatures as opposed to the executives. The focus of this year's recommendations were on infrastructure, and as a key element in the stimulus of economic development, and this we draw from the national. more safe if we deal in terms of our oversight, emphasizing value for money and prioritization in the last period. For the period going ahead, those efforts will need to be leveled. So if we're doing high times, now we need to extract more value from the resources that are in the system. Moving on to slide 5, that paints the broad economic and fiscal outlook for the Commission. Starting with the last 5 years, if there are three take-home points that we can highlight that have been structuring the total national revenue take. The first is that in the last 5 years, global interest rates have been at their lowest level for quite a long time. In fact, going on to the last 50 years, we haven't seen global interest rates at rates that they've been in the last 5 years. And what that did for our budget processes was that it dramatically reduced borrowing costs, which feeds into the budget process. So that is a key factor. The second key factor was that we experienced by even South African standards, quite moderate domestic inflation in the last 5 years, with very few instances of the actual inflation reaching the band that are set for the kind of trend for inflation. And again, what that did was that in terms of cost pressure in the budgetary process, we were getting a benefit from good macroeconomic management of domestic inflation rate. The final one, which is again a key point, is that in the last 5 years, we benefited from another boom that is not much associated with what South Africa does. This was the commodity price boom, which is dictated to by mostly by international development or demand for commodities. And the last 5 years have been synonymous with the period of a commodity price boom. And what commodity prices do for the purposes of our budget processes is that it's one of the key variables that explains the overall SYN or the national revenue ultimately available for the equitable sharing process. One of the key variables that explains that. And in fact, which explains if you acknowledge the efficiencies that start with other revenue gathering institutions, that one variable outside of that that has explained the overperformance on revenue index in the last 5 years has to do with the commodity boom that was experienced in the last 5 years. So those three are the key take-home macroeconomic variables that positions our overall budgetary process. Now trying to look at it, because issues of division of revenue by their nature are forward-looking. We're always working at least 1 year in advance. Now looking forward, what are the key aspects of the macroeconomic and macro and fiscal outlook that we see playing a big role? The first one is the assumption of low global interest rates isn't such a credible assumption now going forward. Already one of the biggest players in determining international interest rates, with the United States, has almost put the world on hold by saying anytime they may now raise their own version of the repo rate. And when that US repo rate was up, most of the world follows take it for granted that borrowing cost, at least not in the next month, but I'm going to be exploring them in the last 5 years. The second one is to do with the issues around commodity prices that we spoke about. Already, we have seen that commodity prices are no longer experiencing the same boom that they experienced in the last 5 years. And this is driven by mostly by global events or matters related to commodity prices. But for South Africa, because of the boom in the last 5 years, that is a way of boosting our national revenue. So going forward, we can expect that if commodity prices continue along the trajectory that we are now forecasting, there's going to be even more pressure on a national revenue take, and as a result, what we have available for a physical share. Again, emphasizing that point as one of the key variables that was influencing the overall national take buoyancy was the commodity price addition. The third and final sector, looking projected 3 to 5 years, is that one variable that we're not seeing in the last 5 years that has now come on the scene is depreciation of the rand versus other international currencies. And what that does in terms of immediate impact on our budget as a processor is that it has a cost push through on the budget as a processor on the wider allocation we have made. So that's the third one. The fourth one we've spoken to when we made submissions to this house around the special appropriation bill for ESCOM around electricity outages. And that if the rate at which outages were taking place in the last year continue as a norm, one can again shave off close to 1% of gross domestic product, putting even more pressure on the available resources. So that's the economic and fiscal outlook. And in terms of oversight, what that tells is that if we were when we're doing oversight, if we're emphasizing value for money, now we need to double our efforts because the environment is even more stringent than it was in the last 5 years because of those three new factors that I've spoken to. As well, in terms of oversight, it now becomes even more critical to exercise oversight on prioritization. What priorities are we funding, particularly at sub-national level? And we propose one key way of checking on prioritization that speaks to economic growth. Mainly for the reasons that I have spoken to, that we've been in standard cross format now quite a long time, and all the need to be on tech on anything that gets economic growth out of the stagnation that is in now. Moving on to the next slide. Okay, now we're back on sector, and I want to get to slide number. Now what this slide does is it gives a high level view of what projections and our specified tell us. In the main, three conditions. First is that there is insufficient financial resources up to what we have seen so far to finance and implement, particularly in the power of investment plan. So the take-home message from all
turn to the recommendation for the chapter, which is the next slide. The essential five recommendations for this chapter. The first one talks to redesign capital provisional plan so that they allow for dealing with important planning aspects of infrastructure, dealing with some conditions for critical infrastructure that can be made even more stringent in the grant framework, allowing the conditional grants to be flexible when a credible infrastructure plan is being demonstrated. The second one talks to a big issue that although we have a network infrastructure plan, what we don't have is a full funding strategy for that national infrastructure plan. We know bits and pieces of it, but we don't have a fully costed responding to fiscal reality financing plan for that national infrastructure plan running all the way up to 2030. And it's absolutely important that to an infrastructure plan, we have a financing plan for that infrastructure plan. Then the final set of recommendations speak to, using a grant framework to build skills, particularly skills for mounting infrastructure going forward. The second chapter is on capital spending. With a view to affecting economic growth, particularly at municipal level, where economic growth is measured through gross value added for municipalities. Now, what that diagram shows is if you look at the red line on top, from 2009 roundabout, you see a bump up in the share of capital spend in total spending at municipal level. So you get that a huge jump, although it's a bigger job, but still quite a big jump. So what that says again in terms of oversight is that the debate is not so much about the policy stance when it comes to SDF, because in terms of policy stance, it's doing exactly what we wanted to do when you're on an infrastructure-led growth. You expect spending on capital to dominate total spending. And you see that come up from 2009 onwards. So the issue is not more debate on policy stance. The issue is actually the dotted line below. That dotted line below is now showing the growth in capital spending as we have gotten the policy stance right. Well, what does it show? Well, from 2008-9 onwards, we see a distinct decline in the growth of capital spending. So although we have been changing, shifting the share of capital spending, total spending, still the rate of growth of that capital spending has been low. And what are the reasons? Well, the reasons in the main, because what the policy stance right has to do with economic growth. That is the main variable that is explaining why we suddenly taken a knock on the rate of growth of capital spending, even at local government level. So the main issue that raises how do we turn around the budget line below? What is it that we do in terms of prioritization to get economic growth firing even at local level? Moving on to the second slide, which we take all South African municipalities together and try to look at the approximate sectors that drive municipal growth. And what we find is that in the main, the specific functions on what municipal capital is spending for does matter for municipal growth. So it really makes a difference where you spend your money at municipal level. When capital spending on electricity, water and sanitation, there is
serve the members for the economic club. But what we find is for South Africa as a whole, South African universities taken together, and noting that this is pulling of average, outlays on housing and road infrastructure actually has negative effect on economic growth. And when we disentangle that even further, one of the main reasons for the housing plan is the road infrastructure has a negative effect on economic growth. It has to do with the role that municipalities and cities, what is their ultimate role? Their ultimate role is essentially connectivity. They connect people where they live, where they work, or where they go to school. In a lot of the instances, we found housing units that are not connected to economic activity. And so you're not going to get the cost dividend when your housing land or housing or infrastructure are disconnected to areas of economic activity. You can end up pumping a lot of money into these two areas. There will not be effect on economic growth. So there's nothing that we're saying is on the surface wrong with investing in housing and road infrastructure. But if you want to have positive effect on economic growth, it must be connected to areas of cross-value or areas of economic activity within that municipality. Coming to recommendations, three recommendations follow from Chapter 2. The first one is land allocation for infrastructure assessment must reflect prioritization for economic growth. In other words, the question that we discussed, particularly with the Chairman Committee on Appropriations during their strategic planning exercise at Arabella, is now being confirmed by the regulation analysis that we've done. Indeed, a fiscal framework that responds to economic growth needs to be emphasized a lot more. Currently, the setup is when you look at the funding system or funding arrangement, it's essentially driven by paying capital subsidies for poor households. The way the system is set up, that's how we've agreed for the system to be set up. But ultimately, the Constitution says the issue is about different spheres of government being able to undertake their mandated functions, and economic growth is really one of the functions for the municipality that we need to really get around to thinking around how we that positively responds to economic growth. The two other recommendations talk to setting motion issues to do with asset and asset management plan. And I think that the vehicle to get asset management plan going. With that chair, I will ask Mrs. Peter to take us through the presentation.
Chapter 3 focuses on intergovernmental fiscal transfers, specifically your indirect conditional grants. And as you know, conditional grants are a key mechanism through which national government provides funding to a municipality or provincial department to ensure that national policy priorities get funding and links priority at sub-national level. So, as opposed to direct conditional grants where monies are transferred directly into the bank account of the recipient municipality or provincial department, indirect conditional grants represent a case where a national sector department or entity performs a function on behalf of a municipality or provincial department. And indirect grants are mainly used in the case of infrastructure, to fund infrastructure development. So no funds are transferred, but whatever infrastructure is developed becomes the responsibility of the sub-national sphere, or whether the province or the municipality. So what we know Minister, is that the share of indirect to direct grants has increased significantly over the past years, growing from 3.9% in 2011-12 to 6.4% in 2013-14, and projections indicate that this will reach 8.9% by 2016-17. What we also noted is that there is no evidence showing that indirect grants perform better than direct grants. So no evidence to show that when a national sector department performs a function that delivery is necessarily better. So what the chapter does is to review change and development in the use of direct and indirect grants. And in undertaking the analysis, we looked at direct and indirect grants across four sectors, namely sanitation, energy, education, and health. And in assessing their performance, we looked at two measures. The first one was a measure of service delivery performance, so looking at the extent to which actual delivery matched up to the targets that had been set. And we also did an expenditure analysis, maybe to identify instances of understanding or good performance. Now the next two slides provide detail on our findings, but just to summarize for you, what we found is that on the issue of non-financial performance, the big challenge was non-alignment of the targets that had been set and the delivery progress that was reported on. So with respect to non-financial performance, we could not say with respect to most of the grants that we looked at, which was performing better directly or indirectly. On the issue of financial performance, the evidence is clear that grant funding is better spent by provinces or municipalities relative to the national sector department. One exception to that trend was in the case of the INET, the Integrated National Electrification Grant, where we found that both the direct and indirect components of the grant performed equally well. The possible reasons for that include the fact that the INET is one of the oldest indirect grants. So it may be that all the teething problems that come with implementation or introduction of the grant have been overcome. Also, it could be that a specialized agency is used to roll out the indirect components of INET in the form of ESCOM. We make three recommendations with respect to this work. Firstly, we advise that national treasury-aligned departments only use indirect grants as a measure of last resort. And further, that whilst the indirect grants are in use, we have a parallel process of capacity building to enable, as envisaged in terms of Section 154 of the Constitution, to enable the sub-national government departments to be able to manage their own affairs and deliver services. Secondly, we recommend that clear criteria are developed to guide the scheduling and rescheduling of conditional grants, and we also recommend what sort of aspects should be taken into consideration as your historical financial performance, non-financial performance, and also the time period that the grant has been in existence for. And then finally, that whatever capacity building plans are developed, that they come with clearly determined targets and time frames. The next set of recommendations are aimed at improving accountability and infrastructure delivery at the municipal level. Now, given the decentralized nature of our three-tier system, municipalities play an important role in the delivery of infrastructure. And when it comes to funding of infrastructure at the local government level, municipalities are heavily reliant on conditional grants. And as I mentioned in the previous chapter, specifically your indirect conditional grants. So what this chapter considers are issues such as where should accountability for conditional grant performance lie? Should it lie with a grant provider, with a municipality, or both? And again, this is particularly important given that we are considering indirect grants where you have a national sector department actually spending or implementing on behalf of the municipality. Also, we consider that given levels of understanding on infrastructure, of councils failing to hold executives accountable, and if accountability lies with the council, how effective are municipal accountability mechanisms? And we look specifically at your municipal public accounts committees and audit committees. There are a number of key findings that emanate from this work, and I'll just stick on a few. Firstly, we found that there's very little accountability between municipalities and their communities, and this is largely because conditional grants are the main source of infrastructure funding, and as such, the accountability is more between, or primarily between the municipality and the sector department that the municipality receives its grant funding from. And when it comes to indirect grants, national sector departments spend on behalf of sub-national spheres. So in that case, municipalities cannot be held responsible for underspending on these types of grants. And the downside of that is that municipalities do not always pay attention or monitor the performance of these grants. And this is important because once the infrastructure has been funded and developed via the indirect grants, the National Sector Department moves out and responsibility for maintaining, rehabilitating, etc. of that infrastructure becomes the responsibility of the municipality. An additional challenge with respect to infrastructure funded by indirect grants is that national departments are responsible for spending of the grant and rolling out the infrastructure, and these departments account to Parliament, and Parliament in turn accounts to the electorate. And what we found is that this long accountability loop may not be the most effective sort of way of dealing with this, because often the wrong parties are end up being held responsible for the spending inefficiencies. What we also found is that the majority of municipal accountability committees or your impact, they lack capacity to scrutinize, interpret, and analyze information on fiscal and financial matters, and this is key information that can be used to hold executives to account. So again, there are three recommendations that we make. The first is that National Treasury, together with the Department of Cooperative Governance, develop a framework to guide accountability for indirect infrastructure grants. The second recommendation is about strengthening accountability structures within municipalities, and more specifically that incentives of providers within the existing transfer schemes for research and technical support to these types of committees. Finally, with respect to this work, we recommend strengthening and institutionalizing social accountability, and more specifically that an accountability framework be developed by SALGA to guide communities on how to hold local governments accountable. Chair, I'll hand over to my colleague to take you through the last few chapters.
Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, Mrs. The last set of chapters speak to improving set capacity through education as well as innovations. Now the first chapter looks at the fiscal arrangements of financing ECT infrastructure. Now we know that ECT is an important carbon quality, and the evidence is widespread in terms of the benefits of ECT infrastructure in terms of improving educational outcomes in the country. Now the point of departure for this study is that when we look at the financing of ECT in South Africa, we find that the sector is greatly under-resourced and is a long history of under-investment as well. The methodology. Just moving on to the key findings, there are potentially three key findings that I would like to focus on in terms of what we found in the study. The first one was that when we looked at the funding of EC infrastructure currently in South Africa in government, what we find is that essentially there is no systematic program to finance EC infrastructure. So, for example, we have a current subsidy even though compliance with infrastructure goals that set is a theory opposed to access to subsidy. Further, there is a lack of clarity in terms of the policy framework itself, whether government should be regulating ECD infrastructure or whether they should be providing ECD infrastructure. So on the one end, you have in the constitution saying that municipalities should provide child or rather be responsible for child care facilities, but it doesn't specify whether that means a regulatory function or whether that means provision of child care facilities. The third important finding of the study was that when we looked at way of how ECD infrastructure is actually financed, we did find that it's basically financed in certain sectors in government. So you have municipalities that finance ECD infrastructure, you have provinces that finance it, you've got FACTA that finance it through the EPWP, and also you have Department of Rural Development and then you hope that finance it through the Comprehensive Rural Development Program. But when you look at how it's being financed, you see that it's being done in a disjointed way. There's no coherent plan that actually underpins the way that these infrastructure is actually implemented. Now, moving on to the recommendations, and I'll just summarize the recommendations. The first recommendation speaks to setting up a rather that government should finance, should partly or fully finance or subsidize constructing upgrading NPO as well as community ECD facilities, and this should be financed with the municipal infrastructure grant. So it's a specific instrument, and so we are recommending it that that instrument should also be used as a mechanism to finance ECD infrastructure, specifically at community level. Then the next recommendation calls for a temporary funding program to be put aside in the Department of Social Development to finance private ECD facilities that are operating in the 4 years. The third and the fourth recommendation seeks to developing an ECD sector plan and for provinces to actually lobby for the ECD sector plan to be incorporated into the IDPs of municipalities. And then the final recommendation basically raises the issue of making technical skills available to those ECD institutions that want to upgrade the ECD facilities. Now moving on to the next chapter, the second chapter speaks about looks at public sector productivity and specifically how it can improve the security of education in South Africa. Now, we know that, and the picture is painted in chapter 1, of the existing economic environment. In other words, the surpluses that we enjoyed prior to the global recession. socioeconomic status of our household is quite closely correlated to poor access to public transport and also poverty, which could be driving the poor educational outcomes that we found. So with respect to that, recommendation 3 is calling for that those socioeconomic programs that the government is currently implementing, which improves living standards and income for households, should be continued, especially those that lead to improved educational outcomes. And the reason we are saying that is given the economic environment we are under, there are obviously going to be issues of trade-offs that we have to take, that we will have to consider. And therefore, what this study shows is that those socioeconomic programs actually do enhance educational outcomes and therefore should be maintained. And then the third finding of the study was, with the given resources available, carbon can improve educational outcomes and secondary education. And here's the key issue is that educational ethos at schools play an important role, which is underneath our school government and school government as well as school management. And with respect to that finding, we're saying that government should not just investigate funding, but also non-funding mechanisms to improve productivity in public ordinary schools and visit. A few ways that government can actually go about doing that. And then finally, the last set of recommendations relate to how government can improve the operations to the use of ICT. And here we specifically focus on what are some of the barriers or the constraints that actually inhibit investment in ICT in South Africa. Moving on to some of the key findings, and we have touched on two or three key findings that emerged in the study. Firstly, currently what we found is that there are a number of players in the ICT sector who have Department of Communication and Postal Services, we have Science and Technology, we also have Department of Public Service and Administration. But also at the same time, we have provinces as well as municipalities in the section doing their own thing. All of this has resulted in duplication and a lack of clarity in terms of who is actually responsible for the overall outcome of ICT in government. What we also found is that there is a need for closer alignment to policy, process, and implementation. So on the one hand, what we know is that the National Development Plan states that the medium-term goal is 100% broadband coverage by 2020. And this is an important prerequisite to achieve the second NDP goal, which is widespread e-government by 2030. So what we do have currently is that we've got a broadband policy in place, but no fully costed implementation plan to guide budgeting and the actual attainment of specific coverage for broadband in South Africa. All this is basically due to a situation where we have an e-government policy in place that has been dropped off since 2001. Now moving on to the set of recommendations, and here we've got four recommendations for this chapter. And essentially what we're calling for is that the policy framework should be corrected first before we move on to looking at the financing arrangement. So the first recommendation speaks to the policy and regulatory framework to be simplified and also for roles and responsibilities to be clearly delineated. The second recommendation calls for the department responsible for e-government policy will finalize and the e-government policy should be identified, and also that a fully costed implementation plan should accompany this. And this is quite important in order for this implementation plan to be published, in order
that it isn't the case anywhere in your presentation. I appreciate this might not be your focus, but it should surely come into account when you look at overall funding of municipalities and how they operate. Obviously, grant funding is imperative. It has to happen because they are underfunded. They are incapacitated when it comes to collecting the money, but that side of it should be emphasized and improved so that there's less demand on the national fiscus rather than more demand, even if the percentage of money out of the national fiscus that goes to municipalities should be increased, and I believe it should, because I think 9% of our total revenue is too little to expect municipalities to operate effectively. The other thing that I notice is that there's, unless I missed it somehow, not enough emphasis to my way of thinking on eradicating the overlap that we have. Just as a simple example, if you look at water and sanitation, it's something that appears nationally, provincially, and in local municipalities. And there seems to be a lot of areas of overlap where the one expects the other to do the function and then it doesn't happen there, so that goes on down the line. And eventually we just find that that essential service is just not getting delivered because of all the inefficiencies and incapacities that exist throughout the system. Maybe we should focus a little more on eradicating the areas of overlap to make them more streamlined kind of function. The same could be said for housing, which operates in the same fashion. We know, unfortunately, from what's been presented to us recently, that water and sanitation is the worst performing department that we have. And yet it is the prime department because it's the one fundamental service facility that provides life. As they say, water is life and sanitation is dignity. It's essential. We have to get these things right. On the ECD side, I'm very pleased to see that the department or that FFC is looking at that because it's also another essential element. In the municipality I came from, we had a sort of joint venture going between the Hollard Foundation and the municipality to address this very issue. And the Hollard Foundation was providing the money, and we were providing the facilities and the availability of things. And what we realized was that many of the early child development centres, for example, cannot be compliant with all the rules and regulations in order to get the ministerial certificates and permits and things because they don't have the money. But they fulfill that need all the time. You can't stop them. People have to go to work, they have to put their children with places to be looked after while they're at work. So you can't stop them operating. But at the same time, you can't efficiently allow them to operate because they're operating without the necessary permits and things. So I think it's essential that we look at that with a view to, as you say in here, facilitating that aspect of it, that they must be made able to comply. It doesn't help just saying, well, you can't have a permit because you can't comply. You don't have the right number of toilets of the right size, etc., etc. You know, they're fulfilling a really basic and necessary function within, particularly in the informal settlement type situations where you find many ECDs. They run in containers, they run in shacks, etc., etc. It's very difficult for them to comply with all the requirements we have. We found we have to try and bend the rules a little at the municipal level in order to allow them to keep functioning without our officials going and closing them down. Because what happens then is those children live to wander about the streets in front of themselves. So I think we need to be very, very humane and very sensitive about our approach here, because I think it's extremely important that we do need to address that, and I'm very pleased to see that there is a new approach here, Mr. Thank you, Chairman.
It's very important that during our constituency work, our program, we include persons in ECD centers. That is very crucial. Are they equipped to do what they're supposed to do? Yes. Number two?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I must say that whenever there's a presentation by FSC, the information is always useful, and again, so it must have been quite a difficult task to put what's in this book into people don't seem to think so, is that one which talks to the transparencies and interstellings and service to the targets was spent by this. And I've seen some of the recommendations, there's a proposal made for more money. Now that might be problematic because I'm not so sure if the funding is ready. It might be one of the problems, but I don't think it's the only problem. So one just needs to look at drawing the balance between the funding and maybe the capacity and the necessary skills. Slide number five, I noticed in one of the indications, the one about the depreciation of the land, my understanding is when your currency depreciates, then there should be a demand for your goods and services because they become cheaper for foreign things like foreign direct investment and obviously, you know, the purchase of goods and services. Why is that not happening from outside the global economy? I mean, we are part of the global economy, so why is there in a rush to invest in this country slide number seven. Yeah, you see now again, it's sort of related to what I mentioned now in the previous slide. This raising of public debt. Now that's good and well. Obviously, one needs borrowing, and Andrew's mentioned that the cost of borrowing was very favorable while the interest rates were low. But with the land depreciating and the interest rates that are going to increase, it's going to cost more, plus our aging, our credit rating, which seems to be going downward, and there seems to be another downgrade which is looming with regards to the credit rating. So raising public debt might be problematic because the debt increases. If the public, if raising of debt is useful, right? Spend on the right items like infrastructure, sure, you know, income generating assets, then it will work. But if it's used for, you know, things like more social grants, and I'm not for one saying you must look out for, but then it becomes problematic. So raising public debt is good as long as it's used for the right purposes. So that's just my concern there. Slide number 15. Yeah. Those criteria that are used with regards to scheduling and rescheduling of conditional grants taken into account, etc. Now, there's one tool or instrument that I see that's missing there, in my view, this is what the way I see it. You talk about historical performance and non-financial performance. Now, at the end of the day, once the money has been spent, then there's nothing that can be done. Should we not look at maybe something like a standard costing technique where one should look at what should be spent for a particular specific outcome instead of looking at the end of the day, we spend so much but we haven't achieved what our desired outcome should be. So it's just maybe something that one needs to look at. Honorable Chair, I'm nearly done. Slide number 20. We talk about the incentives and that is some of the recommendations on a few of the chapters, but should there also not be some sort of penalty for underperforming municipalities and SOEs as well? Because now you're giving people incentives, but you're not penalizing for non-performance, which can be problematic. Then in slide number 26, and this might be a sensitive one, but this is about the education. We know what the state that our education is in. Should we not maybe do an analysis and look at the effect or the negative effect of trade unions that are placed on education? Because we know, we see now that they are being involved in government decisions because the minister now communicates with them to make decisions. So should we not also look at any negative effects that have been brought about by trade unions? And then last, Honourable Chairperson, no, that was my last. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just have some few inputs and some questions that I want to raise regarding the additional year 2014 and 2015, local government had a capital budget of 65.4 billion. And the National Treasury third quarter report shows that only 50 billion was spent. Not only local government, but also provinces and national government reflect poor spending on infrastructure. Now, in your presentation, when you were talking about infrastructure, can you outline for me what is the recommendations that you guys are having to combat this underspending, if you have, or if you can, maybe if you don't have it now, you can start do a submission to the portfolio committee or the portfolio secretary. Then number two, Chair, we have seen the grants when they were presenting that municipalities and departments are having tendency of playing and transferring the chief grants. How are you going to build capacity or monitoring that these grants are not transferred and municipalities and departments are just playing a ball game with that grant system? And then on the presentation, there are just some wording that I just need some clarifications to, in terms of slide number 21, under resource, if you can also give for a certain submission, what do you mean by under resource, or if it's in the book, if you can give us a notification and to compare to that. Thank you, Chair.
We will give the Treasury also an opportunity to make their input after the responses. Number four.
Thank you again for the opportunity.
I think it's an excellent presentation. In fact, I'm very impressed with talking about what I see, and I think it is a true broad line of current circumstances. Chairperson, forgive me, but I might overlap with a few issues that were already mentioned, so I'll try to be brief. If we just go to page 4, I was looking at what was raised that infrastructure is aging and often badly maintained. The municipalities and federal enterprises are failing to meet service delivery targets. So the question that arises is how proactive are we? And I mean, I can respect that you're saying to us that we pull up the stocks and do something concrete, but we really have to take the bull by the horns and think about this. On the issue of, we can no longer afford extensive borrowings. Commodity prices are down. My colleague alluded to that, and the depreciation in the rand, which is a huge problem. The issue that comes to mind is brief sentence, the commitment that we have in terms of the $10 billion, and in terms of the huge cash flow pressures that we're coming under, and the depreciation in the rand, it's something that we have to talk about and always keep at the back of our minds. Because we go on and talk about borrowings, I don't know, in terms of the fiscal space, in terms of our balance sheet, how much space do we have in terms of our borrowings, and how much deeper do we get into debt, liabilities, and servicing of insurance. I think it's a tough balancing act. At the same time, we have to drive the infrastructure, creating jobs, and obviously the issue of tax buoyancy comes up now. So yes, it's a great document, and lots of food for thought, and if you go to the, I'm going to just skip a few questions because I think a few were already alluded to. The issue, I just want to mention, the issue of district municipality comes to mind as a person, and the billions of rands that are being extended through the district municipality. Do we not really have to start taking the cognizance that the district municipalities are really leading us? Is it really resulting or giving us a return for our investment in terms of district municipalities as such? One could say millions that we're spending at district municipalities, are they $59 million gone to? Would you respect, you know, Jefferson, I think I'll just stop it. Thank you.
I can't answer that question. It's hard to grow the department where the money has gone to on a quarterly basis, not one year.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I simply enjoyed this presentation. It was magnificent. In fact, I want to dish out a couple of t-shirts for this presentation.
How good it was.
But I'm going for blue. So on my biggest shock is slide 8, where it shows the real development of infrastructure. And I think of when the SIPS announcement was made through the PICC, and how we asked questions to each department, to the ministers, which are our most important SIPS projects and how are they funded. And when you go to the provinces, I believe now they're going for a provincial infrastructure plan where some of these plans are going to be prioritized, which is amazing. But are they going to be prioritized according to these guidelines, or are they now going to be political promises before an election? And these provincial infrastructure plans that are going to come from the provinces, how are they affecting municipalities? I have full understanding that when you talk about the railway line that must take 4 trains of 200 trucks going from the Northern Cape to Kuha, that it's a provincial project. I understand that. We can put them on one side. But how are these mega projects relating to our municipalities and their infrastructure plans? Because in the big run of it all, and I'll tell you why I'm saying this, should the Nuclear Build One program take place within the next year and we start with it, what infrastructure has been set aside or budget has been set aside for Kokha Municipality to be able to cope with a project of that nature? And I am talking about disaster management, I'm talking about the upgrade of the grid, I'm talking about so many other aspects like just plain infrastructure. It's not there. The housing program at the very moment is lagging behind because there's a lack of mixed funding available to upgrade the mega, the bulk infrastructure. So that's where I want to see the big pictures going, so that when you look at the PICC, how it affects the province, and then how it relates to the municipal budget and the IDP. And unless we can talk in that line, we're going to float around unnecessarily and wasting a lot of money. When it comes to grants or grants by national departments, I'm very concerned, and I've noticed that the Department of Economic Affairs has given, for instance, funds to build cultural centres and rock art centres and so on all over the country, or other projects that we've seen in KZN. And the first thing that worries me is the, and it's mentioned here in this report, the project management. Now, to be able to do project management, you have to have a qualification. And you've got to be a registered person. And you can't get into project management on, CIDB or BD? You can't get in on a project and you've been there for a year and then suddenly have reached the top qualification that you can be with bigger projects than people that have been there for years. So that whole aspect must be analyzed. When you look at these big projects that are coming, which we found in KZN, the eco center is being built, but there's no operational plan. The, the sort of Bartman Cultural Center in Human in Kahanki, 163 million rand. And there's no definite plan as to how to operate that once it's been completed. Then when it comes to district ministers, please to add on to my colleague's comments here, I believe that somewhere in the Eastern Cape they're now running a different, a new model for a district municipality. I would like to know if that model was run past the SFC. Because I think some people, Chairperson, I don't know if there's another word for gier. Some people get a gier and then they want to impose something, and I don't know if they're doing their homework and research via proper departments that we have. And lastly, social development. The ECD functions, I'm very happy that something, there's a definite plan on paper, and I'll really work on that one. The issue there is that our teachers are not even looked at. They are getting a stipend of, I think it's 5,000 rand at the moment. I don't know if it's the same across all the provinces. Then they get promised, like in the Eastern Cape, they get promised that their salaries will be put up 7,000 rand a month. Then they go, no, we haven't got money for that. It's really unfair. And I just need to go back to the grant and project management. The cost of layers between the actual department or the funding department and the construction of the projects on the ground, there are a number of agencies and layers of people. Can we please look at putting the professional people in charge of the project so that that person, if it's meant to be an architect or an engineer or something like that, then please, then we have a right to say, but you do not have a license, we must take your license away because you cannot perform your functions that you are qualified for. But at the moment, it is chaos, and I really need some advice as to how we must address this. Thank you, Jacob.
The PDO is also present, Julia, making your notes, needing advice, so you can pass on your advice. After the responses that Leslie and the PDO also replied. You see, all the members, the FSC Agri Diagnostic Analysis and come up with recommendations to the minister. When the Division of Revenue is tabled, the reply of the minister is there. It's our task as committee on a quarterly basis, and I'm stressing this, to monitor the spending but also the performance on a quarterly basis. Why? To get trained. What is happening? But that is where the research unit comes in. To go back 2 or 3 years in history, what is the history of this report, the trends? And then you can just give us an analysis of now. You're not going to get any further. And then you can go on to the next quote. In APAC, we were trained in 2013.
can also be distinguished from devaluation. We're not talking about devaluation. Devaluation is an explicit policy by authority to reduce the value of the rand relative to the outside currency, whatever it could be, to get export going on. That's not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about the natural market-driven process when the rand depreciates because of sentiment, mostly driven from external conditions. And that was certainly the business and services that we consume domestically, which was more effective. Then the second set of related questions had to do with the issue of borrowing and raising a public debt. Let me explain the recommendation. The first point, as it's been raised elsewhere, is that grant funding is but one aspect of overall infrastructure sector, including financing of our government operations. Okay? Grant financing is just one small part of that. The other part are what we refer to on revenue running municipalities and systems, etc. But now, when you look at the municipal space, there are municipalities that can run a credible debt policy to get infrastructure assets going. Those are the ones that we are referring to here, and that's why we have a criteria that goes after the recommendation. And part of the reason for that recommendation is also that through debt policy, using strategically, you can actually free more grant funding when you can some municipalities with capability of funding debt policy from taking on the same sort of grant funding. And then when you take that together with the macroeconomic factor that we can no longer assume global interest rates to be low, and you open up domestic borrowing for these municipalities, then you are likely strategically thinking that if you build up domestic debt relative to foreign debt, you can generate savings through your domestic debt policy in the situation that we're in. In other instances, for provinces, for example, it could be that given legislation, etc., nationals can borrow at lower cost than an individual province or municipality can. And within the financial space, there are instruments that allow for all those arrangements to take place. And you are not prescribing exactly how that should be done. And leave it to governments.
letting them stay away from using this instrument to implement the municipal infrastructure plan consistent with the national development plan. So that was one major worry that we are seeing the tapering off of the declining trend from municipal forum, particularly municipalities with capability and room to perform. What's
so that simply is also an accountability board for the citizens in particular. How we work with PID citizens to ensure that what they're driving dovetails to our municipal infrastructure plan, provincial infrastructure plan. Because if that link gets broken, then again, we'll not be going anywhere with this. Then the capacity challenge is identified for KwaZulu-Natal in particular. These are real issues, real big issues that we're even worrying about, including for other provinces. And now, let me say it straight. We know that there are many interventions to address the capacity challenges. You can talk COP33, mutual interventions, etc. Yet still, even from the honorable member, she can just pull out examples of where it's just not happening. So it's probably time to use a big thing to say, member of PICC, give us what has happened in the last 3-5 years. We are seeing all these things that are looking nice on paper, but on the ground, we are not seeing this. We are seeing project management being done by somebody that's not qualified to manage a project. We are not seeing projects adopting a life asset approach to it. We are not seeing the conditions for ensuring that tools are in place being exercised oversight. What is happening? That's because on paper, there will be a response that we do have this plan. Now it's 25 years down the road. So now the conversation should probably not be about what should we have on paper, but why is it that when I walk into the case of them, what I think of indisputable?
What is it? You can tell the gentleman, he doesn't have to be very diplomatic. Call a spade a spade and just tell it like this.
It's not in his nature. I know it.
Very diplomatic.
He's very pretty, no? I'll protect it. Are you done? Any other additions in the response? Are there any quick follow-ups? I know members are itching to leave. None. PBO, Nelia?
Thank you, Chief. I don't think I have anything to add, but I think I totally agree with Mr. Rommel that year after year after year we see almost the same pattern. We don't think and we identify the issue. We make recommendations, we make changes. We implement new plans, infrastructure plans. We provide monthly skills. We implement the project management units. All those kind of interventions, but still nothing works. So, what are you saying that we actually need to do to get some of the municipalities to spend the infrastructure funding? And in terms of the direct and indirect grants, I also found that in some cases, the direct portion is implemented or the responsibility of the same person that's implementing the indirect portion. So if it's not in the direct portion, how can that be in the indirect portion? So thank you.
That was a PBO. Yesterday I received a quarterly overview of the economic environment, etc. I hope you send it to all members. We will engage on that, but it's very important to read that. Treasury, Wendy.
Thank you very much. Like the chairperson pointed out, the NGDCS is going to be released on the 21st of October. And a lot of what is going to be contained in the 2016, or what is the intention to be contained in the 2016 MTS is going to be contained within that document. And in particular, what will be important for members to focus on are the changes that have been intended in terms of the grant with respect to problems as well as municipalities, and then also to what extent it actually also then to some extent in response to the FEC recommendations. The government responds to the FEC recommendations, and that is only done when the budget is formally tabled in February 2016. And the recommendations have been contained in the Division of Revenue bill, is those that's directly related and indirectly related to the Division of Revenue Act. But what is quite important for the committees as well is some of the recommendations that the FFC makes are very pertinent and relate back to policy. And the appropriate national department to respond to that is the national department responsible for that sector. So some of the questions with regard to, e-government and the like, those are policy-related issues that dealt with that department. And we do try to assist the FFC as well by informing those departments if they need to respond to the FFC, and the FFC indicated to us that they also do have some benefits in that process. Then also what is quite useful for the committee is the reports that we produce and also submit to Parliament with regards to spending in both provinces and municipalities. There is what we call the Section 32 report and the Section 71 report. What is also quite important is that those reports also get given to the provincial legislature and that the municipalities and provinces that have been underperformed be held accountable in the provincial election, which could be quite a useful process. Then with regard to some of the issues mentioned with regard to departments that work at, particularly national departments that work at cost services, what could also be quite useful is for joint sessions of committees and calling in departments concerned. I can think of one that happened with regard to sanitation, for example, where a number of committees actually called a number of national departments in and then agreed on the way forward. So that could also be quite useful. Then just a few issues also that I think is quite important and pertinent. It's very easy to spend expenditure. And expenditure should also be used with quite a bit of section because there's various ways of spending the expenditure. You can spend all your money, 100% of your money, and have zero impact. So that is quite a difficult issue. So what
you get a good audit report, but you can't actually.
Yeah, and that is quite important. And then sometimes some of the grants perform quite well in terms of expenditure, but if you really look at the performance side, you really don't have the necessary impact. So it is a very important issue and how you start measuring that. The second issue with regard to expenditure that's also quite important is that you need to differentiate short-term expenditure against long-term liabilities. For example, you could actually build something on the outskirts of the municipality and the land is very cheap. So if it's cheap to purchase the land, so then you put in place the bulk infrastructure to support that infrastructure is then much more expensive. The transport cost in there is also much more expensive. So sometimes it's actually better to spend more in the short term because you gain much more in the longer term. So those are quite important in the process. Then just some interesting things also then to note. We have made presentations also to various committees. We've introduced some of the reforms in the grant systems that have had some of the benefits that we're looking for. In the provincial grant system, we have introduced the characteristic approach, where you get a base allocation, but if you do the right things and you've got the right capacity in place and you've got life cycle costs in place, then you get a carrot allocation as well. that is one of the benefits that we had. And it took about 10 years to actually took from to build the capacity. We introduced it 2 years in advance, warned them that the system that's coming along to make themselves ready. We are seeing the benefits. We're also providing support to the provinces that could not make the criteria as well. We're doing the same on the metro side as well. We've also introduced a self-centered approach. We're in the sector of all these performance plans, which is also been linked to ensuring integrated team settlement. And we had a study tour on that via the Standing Committee of Fines. That was also quite useful. They actually went to some of the sites to actually look at progress made. We've also, linking up to the recommendation that the FSC has made, the concern that, particularly for economic infrastructure, that particularly metros and larger secondary cities are not taking the space they should. What we've realized is that it's important for us to reconnect the relevant stakeholders, and we have what we call an urban infrastructure partnership conference on the 28th and 29th of August, where we invited the private sector, developers, bankers, financiers, and the municipal governments concerned, and they presented their plans on where they want to invest. We also listened to the private sector on what they require from us, and going forward, we're going to strengthen that interaction to actually regenerate the municipal borrowing market, but to borrow for the right type of things. And then the last point I'd like to make is that we should also look at some of the good work that the OPCO is doing and actually looking for value for money. But it's not just linked to the OPCO. For example, they're working out costing of what it will cost to build as a benchmark, so that we've got a measure to measure how much it will cost for two, for example, of the system cost, so that you've got something to measure that value for money. But, for example, other benefits that we've also seen has been done by the Minister and the Department of Health in terms of securing very good contracts for medicine as well, and bringing the cost down quite substantially as well. So there's quite a lot of good things happening as well. So yes, there's quite a bit of things that still need to be done, but there are things to be able to do positive benefits for people.
I don't remember.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to thank the comprehensive input. And I'd also to comment that in the training that you mentioned, where you and I were present in 2001-2004, the emphasis was on the fact that accountability must be exercised by the legislative parliament. All what went wrong is our responsibility, and we must take it. Where were we? Where we passed the thing when all these things happened? We need to call departments to account at least 4 times a year, at least. We need to keep track of that. You know, if you care to read accountability in other countries in the world, like the UK and America, you will remember that the first president of the US had this to say, that people will not account unless they are made to account. It is our job to make people account. We give them money and we go to sleep. They will do what they like. We need to keep departments on their toes. We need to hold them to account. And I would like the PBO to maybe to assist us in just giving us a list of provinces where they don't comply with cooperative governance. Because, you see, it's not a question of choice or decision of us in the committee. It's a constitutional later. Chapter 3 of the Constitution has been to say that all spheres of government shall conduct their business in a manner that does not divide the Republic of South Africa. So they have to work together. We can't have year in, year out, people coming with excuses why they did not work together. They've got to, and we've got to make them work together. That is my humble comment.
Brilliant, sir. Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Members, yes, in future, SALGA must be part of this meeting as well. Reference is made frequently to SALGA. SALGA must be invited to the briefing on the NPDS as well. We are calling in through the NCP, the provincial chairpersons of the portfolio committees on finance in the provincial legislature to come and attend those briefing sessions, to be on board. Very important point mentioned on page 20, very important, Jens Salga is included here. I'm just shortening this sentence. To guide communities on how to hold local governments accountable. Remember, that's our job. Take that original revenue document, the bill that became an act, and go and explain it to your people, the people in the town. Call them, have a community meeting. Get your sectors, explain to them where does the money come from, where is the money going to. And that's the back of the division of revenue. For 3 years, you get the allocations to municipalities and different municipalities. What does it tell us? They must do multi-year planning. And that's what we have to zoom into. Regarding infrastructure development. Namapa, what is your plan for the next 3 years? Because you know what you're going to get. Put it on the table. Get into your car and drive the route to see what they're going to do. Something water from the Orange River into a pipeline in Springbok. Above water supply. That money was spent well. Yes. That's the things we have to look at. Twice, Yoshini, the water development program in Yoshini, distributing water to a vast area, including a lot of people in villages, bringing clear drinking water to households. Basic service delivery. But the pipes are ordered on time, towers installed, which is just lying there in the sun. Things like that, your planning, in terms of your money allocations. Multi-year planning, against SALGA, including municipal managers, CFOs, and mayors. Impact. Impacts must be assisted. Coming back to APAC. Link on to APAC, those training. The role of a counselor to do oversight. How do you do the oversight? Some of them are not used to it. Again, we take our councillors on board. Come with me when I do my constituency work. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to look at. Hold the officials in your municipality accountable. Full stop. If you don't perform, you've got the choice. You prove yourself or leave. One of the two. Because it's costing the country money. Lastly, rural development that came out here in one of the replies. Rural development plus agriculture, it goes together. Plus lockdown, it goes together. Plus water effects, it goes together. What does it say to each other? Intergovernmental relations. And this we must focus on to improve it. Referring to the agri-box, we listed that in case of office. You will the way forward. A report will be compiled, and then the two committees will then sit on the report and approve and adopt it, take it to the House. Our next joint engagement will be on the 21st of October, the 22nd, and the 23rd. So that's the good news. Working together for 3 days to start the processing of the NTPDs. The Secretariat, any announcements? Thank you very much.